Recently, we discussed oral health with science writer Jasmine Fox-Skelly, and the chat downloaded heavily, and you had questions. And in some cases, the questions have been above Jasmine's pay grade, as it were. You got into quite a lot of nitty and gritty, and she referred us to Dr. Alp Kantachi from Oral Health at Harvard University. The thrust of our first chat wasn't just to do with the obvious importance of looking after our teeth and gums. It was about the increasing recognition from ongoing studies that bad bacteria get into our bloodstreams from our mouths, and they can precipitate or exacerbate heart disease, Alzheimer's, arthritis, cancer. And we shan't go through that again. So if you missed the interview, it's easily found online on the RNZ Sunday page. What we shall do is talk about what we didn't last time. Professor Alp Kantachi, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure. And hello to you as well.
The longest question first. Out of interest, we mentioned in our previous conversation on this topic the possibility soon of oral biome transplants, maybe using the bacteria of people who have no dental or gum problems. And a few people texted in, Alp, and here's an example. Quote, sweet things have always been my vice. Although I don't drink or have any other impactful habits, I'm 51 and have never had a filling or any issues with my teeth. As my dentist once said in jest, your teeth won't put my children through university. Is it possible, Alp, that people like this carry, what, more Neanderthal DNA or something? We know humans once had better teeth and gums. Where does this come from?
I don't know about the Neanderthal DNA, but that's, of course, a big hot issue right now, especially with the Western populations from the European descent. There's quite a bit of Neanderthal DNA. And I, as a matter of fact, I'm from the European side of Istanbul, and I actually do have Neanderthal genes. But I don't think there's enough evidence that this could be linked to your dental health or dental strength. And having said that, we're actually doing a study on that one with a group at Harvard and trying to understand if there's evidence on that, but that's not ready yet. This is the basis of the probiotics and prebiotics. So that's exactly the logic of this, to add the probiotics and prebiotics to the oral cavity, to your diet and so on and so forth, to be able to allow the good guys to grow and pass the bad guys so that they can be actually dominating the field as well. That was the point that I was going to make.
And those products on the market, the good bugs products for your mouth, that's science. That's science backed.
Yes, yes. And not all of them are working the same way. Not all probiotics are created equal. And but there are some of them working much better than the other ones. And yes, and they do work for periodontal disease, for systemic health, for oral diseases and oral cavity diseases such as dental caries, indicated, and so on and so forth.
Understood. Thank you. A listener named Claire asks whether you have a view or any knowledge of the oil pulling technique used in the Pacific Islands. And I think it's also an Ayurvedic one where every morning before brushing, you might put a tablespoon of coconut oil in your mouth and swish it around for 15 to 20 minutes and then rinse out. I mean, aside from the probable unpopularity of taking a quarter of an hour to do this, is this a remedy for a healthy mouth? Others suggested coconut oil, and they suggested that shorter time frames might also work.
I mean, I don't have a direct answer for that, but I know that this is actually a Ayurvedic practice. And I mean, many of the old remedies actually work, not because of their Ayurvedic or historical evidence, but just because of the chemicals inside them. And so coconut oil obviously have a lot of antiseptic products inside them as well. So there are a lot of compounds that can work in antisepsis and for the oral cavity rinse. But some of this also associated with an effect called Hawthorne effect, which is actually much more of a psychological impact of using something versus not using it. So there's not enough science to show that which portion of this is actually really coming from the benefits of the chemical ingredients of the oil versus how much of this one is really coming from the actually the act of using it and the psychological belief that you're actually using it.
Interesting that placebo can work in the mouth as well.
Of course. So in science, for instance, if I'm going to use a stannous fluoride mouthwash or any mouthwash that I come up with, I have to use a group of patients or people that will be given a placebo and with the exact same look, smell, and color without having the active ingredients. And this has to be done for every single active ingredient that we have identified that's going to work. So with the absence of any of these controlled studies, randomized controlled clinical trials, and of course patients should not be knowing which group they are supposed to be, because otherwise they're going to believe, we cannot really come up with the conclusion. And this placebo effect, psychological effect, is extremely important. Just because I give you a mouth rinse, you will be starting to believe its function, and that's going to create much more of a discipline in terms of its using, but also a lot of the hormones and a lot of the inflammatory mediators are going to be secreted based on your belief on something is actually going to work better than what your product is using. This is what we call as a placebo effect, or in general terms as a Hawthorne effect, which is going to be extremely important for controlling the psychological impact of using these products.
Because we got a few questions about mouth rinsing. Actually, here's one of them. Mouth care is simple, no bacteria because we use mouthwash. How useful are the commercial mouthwashes we use, please, for getting into the deep gum crevices we were hearing about?
So, first of all, none of the mouthwashes will be penetrating below the gum line. So that's where the disease is. And so it doesn't mean that these mouthwashes are not good, but the efficacy of them getting below the gum line and attacking the bacteria there and resolving the inflammation below the gum line is very limited. It's very difficult for them to get absorbed. This doesn't mean that mouthwashes are not working. Mouthwashes are perfect ways that we can actually use for delivering active compounds to prevent the disease. But once the disease starts, it's very difficult to treat the disease below the gum line with mouthwashes.
How about those good bugs you were mentioning? Do they get below the gum line?
When the pocket deepens, then there's a becoming a much more of a low oxygen environment in the deeper pockets where the bad bugs can start living much more freely because they don't like oxygen. Oxygen is actually going to be a toxic function for them. In the deeper pockets, there's not going to be that much of a good guy left, and that's going to be much more of a bad bugs living there. And these are the ones that are actually causing gum disease. These are the ones that are causing the systemic results of the gum disease, including going to other organs from the mouth, and that's where the problem starts.
If you take those good bacteria from all the products available, I don't know what they are necessarily, but if you take them, do they penetrate below the gum line, though? Do they join the bad guys down there and maybe supplant them?
You can try it, but it's not going to be an environment they will like because they will require oxygen to live.
Right.
And then deeper the pockets are, think about them as a cave. So in the opening mouth of the cave, you have much more oxygen, but deeper you get, and especially deeper you dive into the cave, you need to have oxygen mask. So that's exactly the reason why this oral microbiome transplant may not work too well. Just because you cannot just change the environment by just transplanting good guys there, because you need to change the environment first.
I like the cave analogy. That's pretty simple to understand. Dr. Alp Kantaja is with us. Mouth ulcers. Please ask about mouth ulcers, said Greg in Ototahi. I understand he says that mouth ulcers can be a symptom of something else going on. Is that correct, Alp?
That is correct. And then the examples can be like basically this cold sores. So they can be related to several viral infections. And the mouth ulcers can also be associated with viruses such as HIV. And so they're not very trivial. I mean, if there's a mouth ulcer that doesn't heal in the next like 6 to 7 days, we should suspect something much more predominant on this one. And usually they are related to immunosuppression, which means that suppression or the shutdown of your defense system. This can also be seen in the times that you can easily get flu, for instance. You may be much more prone to get mouth ulcers because your defense system can go down. There's always a disease reason why most of these mouth ulcers can happen.
A lot of people complained about the cost of dental care, which is a perennial question in our country. I don't know what it's like in Boston, but it's certainly expensive here for most people. And one person asks, why, if we have a good flossing and cleaning regime, do we need to visit dental hygienists? What instructions will we receive other than what we know? It's not a bad question.
It's actually a very good question, and that's universal. And it's true for Boston. Maybe it's even worse here. And there are very few countries in the world who were able to manage the oral care. So I can give you examples. One of the pioneers of this socialized dentistry or socialized dental medicine was Scandinavia. And what they did was they managed to see the patients, and they still do, very frequently. And this is the reason why in 1990s, many of the caries lesions, many of the tooth decay were pretty much extinct, and many of the gum diseases were extinct. So we shouldn't think of the dentist's visits or hygienist visits as something that's going to be only treatment and only we go when we actually have a problem. We should think that as a much more of a preventive strategy. And this can prevent you from much more expensive procedures. For instance, if you are able to prevent decay or prevent periodontal disease or prevent tooth loss, you're going to be actually much more efficient in terms of the costs in the long run. Because just to give an example, I mean, a dental hygiene session in Boston would be costing, let's say, $200 or $100, depending on which source you go. However, if you lose a tooth that is not detected, and because of a lack of hygiene, and you replace this with implant, that costs about $6,000. I will give you another secret. No implant can replace your actual tooth, your natural tooth. So it's actually cheaper, healthier, and long-term, more sustainable to prevent the decay or prevent the loss of your teeth. And that actually is critical for that.
We had a number of people asking about fluoride, and I won't get into the whole fluoride debate, which I'm sure has been had in America as well. We know it can strengthen tooth enamel. What is the effect of fluoride on oral bacteria? I notice some toothpastes have a lot of fluoride in them.
So the fluoride is one of the actually oldest antibacterial, antiseptic compounds out there. And many of these toothpaste and many of the oral rinses include fluoride for multiple reasons. First, as the listener asked about it, it does actually strengthen the tooth enamel and the tooth surfaces that are exposed as a result of disease. And the mechanism of that is that it replaces another ion on the tooth surface to make the tooth structure, which is the hydroxyapatite, stronger. So that's how it works. On top of this, the stannous fluoride, or especially the couple of other forms of fluoride, can also directly kill bacteria. Now, the question is, just like coming back to the original idea below the gum line versus the above the gum line, many of these products especially toothpaste and mouth rinses, cannot penetrate below the gum line. So when you're using the fluoride containing oral care products, they do not really necessarily get absorbed. They do not necessarily penetrate below the gum line. So that's the reason why there's actually going to be limited effect if you have the disease. But for prevention, it is extremely important. There are some applications that can be only done in a dental office professionally by the dentist and their staff that can place the stannous fluoride or other forms of fluoride below the gum line by using a simple and non-invasive injectors. And there are really solid data that this also works to heal the basically gum disease in a much more efficient way. However, this requires obviously a professional treatment strategy that's done by a dental office. So overall, fluoride debate is not something, and the doses that you're talking about are critical or are dangerous if you swallow it. And this can be becoming much more of a problem there. However, most of the times, first of all, you're not supposed to swallow the toothpaste anyway. And in case that you do it in a once or twice, that's not the end of the world. And then usually we use much lower doses, much more content or much lower content of fluoride anyway. In those doses, they are extremely efficient ways to strengthen the tooth surfaces that is going to prevent the tooth becoming decayed anyway.
Okay. Scott asks, what about using a tongue scraper? We use one. It's brilliant at keeping your breath fresh. I've always wondered about what good tongue scrapers do. What's your opinion?
So tongue is a good reservoir for a lot of bacteria, and they're not necessarily gum disease-causing or decay-causing bacteria on the back of the tongue, especially, not on the front of the tongue. So, and there's a big diversity there. So just like anything else, we don't want to completely destroy the tongue habitat by just using this. However, some patients suffer from a lot of halitosis, which is the bad breath, mal breath. And this is mainly stemming from, if they are not related to systemic diseases, such as coming from the gastrointestinal tract, they can be originating from the bacteria in the oral cavity. In those patients, I recommend using the tongue scrapers, and we do get some really good results out of that. However, in most of the patients, this is not a really a 100% necessary approach that you have to follow, because they're not 100% associated with the gum disease or the decay or other purposes. And you have to be very careful about eliminating all of these bacteria from there, because you can also destroy the tongue's surface if you do it too aggressively. So it's not something that I recommend to a lot of my patients.
Okay, that's good information. Dr. Alp Kantaja is with us. This is way out of a layperson's league. Salicylate or salicylate intolerance, I'm hoping my pronunciation's correct. Quote, I have decades of gum disease and it only stopped after my immunologist diagnosed salicylate intolerance that also causes sinus headaches and aggravates asthma. I now have a restricted diet. So I looked it up, and there are quite a few foods that can cause salicylate intolerance, and people can look them up. It got me wondering about other food intolerances and whether their bad effects can start in the mouth as well. Do we know?
The jury is out on that, because I mean, most of these, I would say, emerging allergic reactions, intolerances, are the part of our modern lives, because we do consume a lot of the drugs, different medications. Many of the harmless, quote-unquote, alternative medications can actually cause a lot of the things. For instance, people can be also suffering from very big rushes on their tongues due to strawberries, due to berries, due to nuts. So these type of things are not very easy to detect, easy to predict. And there's also an age factor, because many of us who are not allergic to any of these food items or drugs may actually become allergic in our later life. So this is also showing that our immune system is changing over years and things like that. So that's a very important thing. But as this listener also said, most probably this is causing something much more systemic, which is also shown in the gum disease reflection. So it's not only causing gum disease, it's not causing only one intolerance in anywhere in the body, but it can be causing multiple diseases that can be associated with the same immunological change, which is something that I was alluding to before, saying that it's much more of a deeper mechanism than only showing something that's only related to the gums or like basically sinuses and so on and so forth.
Speaking of links with something much more systemic, and you know, we've already talked about the exacerbation or the precipitation of through the mouth of heart disease and Alzheimer's and arthritis and cancer, all those links that have been either found or suggested. Sally asks, what's the effect of kissing on oral health, which I thought was a good and not frivolous question. What do we think?
There's very little data. This doesn't mean that the couples who are being together for a long time can become very similar in terms of their oral microbiome, but it takes a long time. So this, as I was coming back to the original question, it's very difficult to transplant from one bug to another person in the oral cavity, and with different, completely different background, completely different environment in their oral cavity. So that's very, very rare.
All right, thank you. And the last question, I mean, many people, we've mentioned this before, complain about the cost of going to the dentist, and virtually no country in the world, as you alluded to, offers complete dental care, although I suppose our countries do better than most. We wondered about a cost-benefit analysis which might compare the cost of this, going to the dentist, with the huge cost of treating people with all the health problems that can accrue from poor oral health. And I wonder if anyone has ever run the numbers on this. I wonder, in fact, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked this question, because it's beyond that. So we don't only clean the teeth. We don't only fill and drill teeth. We don't only place implants. We don't extract teeth, but we prevent the diseases from happening. So for instance, we can detect signs of diabetes. We can detect signs of cardiovascular disease. We can detect signs of cancer. It's the only part of the body that you can open it and then take a look what's going on there. You cannot have this type of a measure with heart, no, with your liver, with your brain, with your lungs, for instance. You just have to rely on a lot of other markers that are circulating in your body. But dentistry can be done. So for instance, I can detect if somebody is basically going through a use of other medications, if there can be side effects of this, if somebody has a dry mouth. This is not something easy for people to do. And sometimes this can be the side effects of other medications. So likewise, I can detect if the bleeding gums unnecessarily, extensively in a person who has several other traits can also be associated with diabetes. So there are a lot of patients that we can alert on this one. So it's not only limited to the cost effectiveness of dentistry, but just regular checkup, going to your dentist or dental office every 6 months can allow you to prevent both the oral diseases and systemic diseases.
And that's a very good note to end on. Alp, thank you very much for giving us your expertise and such an informative chat.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm very happy that I can reach out to my friends in New Zealand through you, and then have a great evening and great day.